A U.S. Supreme Court case changes how South Dakota lawmakers discuss protecting children online. From SDPB, today is Monday, September 16th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a legislative study group is seeking ways to require age verification for pornographic web content without running afoul of the First Amendment. Mike Thompson has a look at the case before the court. Attorney General Marty Jackley outlines the challenges to crafting a law that protects your privacy, your rights, and your children. Then, financial advice for your first big job. Rick Kaler provides financial therapy guidance for growing up your money habits, plus new rules for overtime for salaried employees in South Dakota. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Should the state of South Dakota have the right to regulate access to social media and internet websites by minors, including the use of age verifications? Well, in March of this year, the Judiciary Committee of South Dakota's State Senate voted 4-3 to table House Bill 1257. It was legislation designed to require those age verifications for websites that provide adult content, specifically pornography. Now, committee members were concerned about the scope and reach of the bill, and they voted narrowly to not send that bill out of committee, but the full Senate recalled the bill for further discussion. Here is Senator Lee Schoenbeck in testimony.
This is a serious problem. I commend everybody that recognizes that, and quite frankly, I think that's everybody in this body. The issue we have to deal with is we need to make sure that we're actually going to do something about it and that we find out how we can do something about it. There's been discussion going on now for almost a month about how we need to have the legislature have a better understanding how we can occupy the internet space legally and effectively. This bill certainly brings that to a head. This amendment is designed to require the executive board to have one of the summer studies be on what can we do as a legislature to occupy the space. And the reason you want to do it the right way is first because it's important. It's important to fight this scourge on young people. And secondly, you want to do it the right way because the alternative is you fail, you fund the ACLU, which is what other states have been doing. Another reason why the summer study is the right way to go is it lets us use resources we have in South Dakota. It lets us have Dakota State University's internet folks assist us in understanding what we can do. And the U.S. Supreme Court is going to decide those Texas and Florida cases that were argued last week. And so we're going to have a better idea about what the rules are, about what we can legally do. And so this amendment is about making it clear that we want to do something and that we want to do it right.
Eventually, the state legislature voted to study the issue further, combining it with other concerns about technology and how lawmakers should regulate it. They called it the Study Committee on Artificial Intelligence and Regulation of Internet Access by Minors. The group meets again this month with a goal of wrapping up in October. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court will navigate questions of free speech and child protections this session. The court agreed to hear the case Free Speech Coalition v. Paxton. Now, this case has its origins in Texas. The state passed a law that required age verifications on pornographic sites, and the Free Speech Coalition challenged the law and Texas's Attorney General Ken Paxton on First Amendment grounds. Mike Thompson is an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. This case is just one that he has his eye on this session, in part due to its South Dakota impact.
This one comes from the Fifth Circuit. So the Supreme Court long ago said that anytime you burden an adult's access to free speech, in certain cases pornography, adult pornography is free speech. So you can't burden too much that access to that pornography. So the argument is the age verification step is an undue burden on an adult's ability to access adult pornography. And the funny part to me is that anytime you've got the First Amendment colliding with criminal law or some other sort of law free speech, speech, and this is symbolic speech, is still held in high regard. And the court is in agreement on the precedent defining obscenity and all of that. Mm-hmm. And the court is really clear that if you burden the First Amendment protection, you've got to survive, and you being the government, you've got to survive strict scrutiny. We talked about it before. You got to show that you have a compelling interest in regulating the matter, and that the way you're regulating it is narrowly tailored. So regulating obscenity is a compelling interest. It's going to come down to whether it's narrowly tailored. But the Fifth Circuit completely ignored any of the precedent that sets up strict scrutiny. And the Fifth Circuit said, we're just going to use a rational basis here, which mm-hmm. means the government essentially has to show any reasonable basis for the regulation. So in the Fifth Circuit's mind, the age of verification passes the Constitution, therefore the law, the age of verification law is okay. But the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court took it, I think, says that they're going to reverse it. They're going to make it clear that, because the Fifth Circuit says, well, the Supreme Court didn't tell us that they were selecting strict scrutiny. They just picked it. I don't get the logic. Anyway, yeah, I think the U.S. Supreme Court has taken it because they're going to say, now, wait a minute. Anytime you've got a case like this, it's strict scrutiny. But the Supreme Court could say, you know, the age verification button or however that works, that's not too big of a burden.
In the world and as a parent, yeah, how do I protect my kid
yep.
from this insanity that's available to them at the click of a mouse?
Yep.
I want that.
Yeah.
I want the government to help me with that.
Yeah.
But there are limitations to that because I'm not allowed to infringe on somebody else's right to access material that's perfectly legal for them.
Right. Yep.
Free Speech Coalition v. Paxton is already having a direct effect on South Dakota's lawmaking process, as our Attorney General Marty Jackley explains.
I've asked the legislature to pass some type of an age verification for illicit or inappropriate materials on the internet. So the legislature is going to be hopefully addressing this very issue, and it's important to moms, dads, grandparents about what kids and grandkids are able to view. It's also important because we wouldn't want steps taken away from adults and their First Amendment rights. That particular Supreme Court decision, I call it the Paxton case. I've had an opportunity to talk to Attorney General Ken Paxton regarding his position and Texas' position, is really going to come down to this. What the Supreme Court of the United States is going to decide is how high is the hurdle of judicial review when looking at these type of laws. Generally speaking, traditionally the law has been what we call strict scrutiny, and really what that means is that's about the highest mountain you could put in front of a law like this. It's hard to survive strict scrutiny. It can be done. Or what was done in the Texas case, the courts applied what's called a rational basis, which is really a fairly smooth mountain, pretty easy to get over, easier to pass legislation. Legislation can perhaps do a little bit more. And so we are waiting for the United States Supreme Court to tell us how high this mountain is going to be. Are we going to have rational basis or strict scrutiny or intermediate scrutiny somewhere in the middle? My advice to the South Dakota legislature is let's draft meaningful legislation that has age verification, that doesn't take away the First Amendment rights of adults, that can survive strict scrutiny, or at least make it easier for me as Attorney General to defend the laws in a federal courtroom if it's challenged under the First Amendment.
It doesn't seem like a difficult thing to have a law that would provide an age verification to get at something that was never intended for the child in the first place. So there's a common sense thing here that I keep stumbling up to again and again. That doesn't seem like it's going to affect somebody else's First Amendment rights if they have to verify how old they are. What am I missing?
It would seem that way. I think the people on both sides are genuine in their positions. I mean, the parents, the grandparents, the faith-based organizations that are pushing this are right, that you should have some type of a checks and balances to make sure that kids aren't seeing things they shouldn't see. The other side of it is concerns if you're going to check verification, you have to gather certain information. You have to gather personal information, driver's license IDs, those type of things that are all subject to data breaches. And also gets to some personal privacy issues. So there are opportunities to do this where You do it at the, for instance, one proposal is to do it at the point you purchase a phone. In other words, anybody that purchases a phone, in order to put certain apps on, et cetera, you just have to show that you're 18 and then you're age verified. Mm-hmm. That doesn't fix phones that are already purchased. It would just grandfather them in, so to speak. But it would begin moving forward that anytime you purchase an app, a phone, a device, you do the age verification and you do it at the point of sale. You don't keep and gather that information. And so there's ways to do this that I think you can alleviate the concerns about collecting personal, private, confidential information. And you can also satisfy the desire of parents and grandparents to not have kids looking at some of this. Yeah. So I think if there's a will, there's a way. I think we can accomplish that. And I think we can accomplish it within the bounds of the law that the Paxson case is going to be telling us probably this spring, which will be a little late during the legislative session in South Dakota to react to it, which is why I believe we should draft a law that has the likelihood of succeeding on a strict scrutiny challenge.
Yeah, and there was just a data breach with people's private therapy sessions being made public on the internet. So privacy matters in this day and age.
It does. These are legitimate concerns, but I think good government, less government, can solve it, and we solve it the way we draft it, and we do it smart. We can be the leader in the nation on this. We're going to have a pile of attorney generals come to Deadwood, South Dakota. Hopefully they're going to do a little bit of pheasant hunting on my farm, and we're going to talk about human trafficking in this very topic. And General Paxson will be there, so we'll get his insight directly regarding the case that he's litigating up at the United States Supreme Court. And I think it'll better prepare me as Attorney General coming into session to give the legislature the advice, but ultimately respect it's their decision, and I as Attorney General will defend whatever decision they make.
The Study Committee on Artificial Intelligence and Regulation of Internet Access by Minors meets again this month. They have a goal of wrapping up their work in October. Expect to see recommendations discussed in the next legislative session. South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley hosts the National Attorney General Alliance Working Group meeting October 22nd to 25th in Deadwood. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Rick Kaler is a wealth advisor and president of Kaler Financial in Rapid City. His specialty is financial therapy for adults at every stage of their financial lives. And he is here to discuss the emotions of money and to offer practical, sometimes aspirational advice about saving and budgeting. Today, young adults just starting out their first full-time job. Let's begin with his number one tip for adults earning that first significant paycheck.
First thing that we've got to realize when we start earning a wage is we don't get to keep it all. And so if we spend it all, when it comes time to pay the taxes, we're going to be scrambling. And this is not just with your first time wage earner. I have professional clients that have made $500,000 a year that don't set that money aside. And that sends them to the bank scrambling to try and pay that tax bill. And once you get behind, it's really hard to catch up. Because by the time you get the tax bill loan from last year paid off, you're into the next year, and it can be a real spiral. A good rule of thumb would be 20% out of every paycheck into a savings account. And there's a problem there, because just because a person puts it into the savings account doesn't mean that it will stay in the savings account until the IRS needs it.
Yeah.
You can't touch that money. It's no longer yours. Mm. So this is just super important to be sure that if you're self-employed, that you put the money away. If you are working for an employer, that enough is being taken out of your check. And like I said, if you're unsure as to what your income tax bracket is, 20% is a good round number to begin with.
All right. So start making that plan now. For some people who earn enough money, you might have to pay that quarterly. So it's worth figuring out your tax bracket. If you start out in life and have a fairly high salary, that's worth checking into as well.
Totally. And an accountant can really mm-hmm. help you with that.
Yeah. Saving for the future now. You want to have a little bit in the bank in case of an emergency or a loss of income. Where would you recommend beginning there?
It's important to start putting aside something out of every paycheck when you're first beginning to build up that emergency reserve. Out of every paycheck you get, you want to take out enough to cover taxes. You want to take out enough to start an emergency fund. And you want to take out enough to put into savings for all the expenses you're going to have. You just don't know when those expenses will occur. There's a difference between that savings account and your emergency fund. Your emergency fund is if you lose your job, that you have some money to fall back on to support you between jobs. But the emergency fund is not for the deductible on your insurance policy to cover that. It's not for car breakdown mm-hmm. or home repairs or something like that. Those are expenses you know you're going to have, you just don't know when. So that's actually two funds, one for job loss, one for everything else.
Job loss, so you're going to figure, if you don't have a job yet, then you don't have anything to put in that fund. But as soon as you start your job, how would you do that math? You would look at your monthly salary and then you would say, okay, I need 6 months of this. I better start saving. That might take you 2 years to save up.
It could take you longer than 2 years.
Yeah.
It's really good when you're first starting out as a young adult, you're used to the ramen diet. So it's important to stay on the ramen diet when you get that first job offer. For example, at the School of Mines here, starting job offers are in the low 80,000s. Well, you're coming from living on very little. Now, all of a sudden, you have $80,000 a year. If you can continue your lifestyle, it will take doing a little bit of math to look at your expenditures coming up. How a real easy one is the deductible on your health insurance. If you have a $6,500 deductible on your health insurance, then put around $550 a month into an account so that you can cover those medical expenses. Sure. The same thing, you just estimate how much it would be reasonable to expect in car repairs, maybe an average of $100 a month. How about vacation? What do I need to put aside for a vacation? Maybe I want to spend $2,000 on a vacation, so put $150 a month. So you just go through and break it down like that. And then that comes off the top. That's really important. Yeah. That you have an amount that comes off the top of every paycheck. Once you've paid your taxes, maybe charitable donations or a tithe, you've set aside for all the other expenses you have, then you can blow the rest.
There you go. Now you get to have some fun.
Don't need necessarily a budget for your lifestyle as long as you have set aside everything. And the one thing I forgot to mention is taking off for retirement, the amount that will go to your IRA, your 401k or whatever retirement plan, which I recommend for somebody starting out to be 20%.
So you're going to talk to your employer about their funded IRA, understand how that works. If they don't have one, then should you be looking into 20% of, or?
Yes, if your employer does not have an IRA, you can put up to, I think it's $7,500. It changes every year.
Sure.
Into an IRA. So that might be less than 20% of your paycheck. If you are self-employed, you can do a simple IRA, or you can put probably double that away into a simple IRA. And if, let's just say, you can't put enough into a retirement account, your only option is a normal IRA, then save the rest of it. Hmm. Put it into an investment account, a long-term retirement investment account. But that is so critical. If you can start that at age 22, you could actually stop contributing at age 29. And if that's in stocks and you apply the average growth rate, you'll have $1 million at the age of 65. If you started at 29 contributing to an IRA every year and contributed all the way up to age 65, you'd also have $1 million. So the point is, the sooner you start, the magic of compounded returns will kick in, and it's a big deal. It'll make a big difference in your retirement.
So you're setting aside money for taxes. You're saving in that emergency fund if you lose your job for around 6 months to a year. And then you're setting up some savings accounts or programs for your healthcare deductible, your flat tire on your car, your vacation. You're in your employer's 401k. And now I want to go back to something you said before. You can blow the rest and you don't necessarily need a budget. Say more about that. Hot take.
You don't hear that from guys like me very often, do you?
Yeah.
this is true. It's just like a rule of thumb is, you might get to live on 40 or 50% of every dollar you make. When you put that away, you're probably down to 50%, 40% left. Well, you don't need a budget then for, well, how much am I going to spend on food or groceries or how much on lifestyle or how much on rent necessarily. I mean, it could help get some parameters, but as long as you're not borrowing every month for expenses, as long as you can live, as your lifestyle consumes that 40 or 50%, you really don't need a specific budget. You can do what most of us do, which is we'll spend everything in the checking account. And then that's it. If it is a checking account, it's gone. Well, this allows you still to do that because you've taken care of first things first.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, my successful clients, very few of them, I can think of maybe 2 or 3% have a budget and know where every penny goes. Most of them do it intuitively on what's left, but what they do is they pay everything else first. Everything else we've talked about comes off the top. They don't buy food or houses or nothing else goes out until all of that is paid. You'll be fine.
It'll be pretty self-correcting if you spent too much on clothes and you're eating Wheat Thins for a week. Then you'll remember that lesson pretty quickly and buy your food first next time. Or if you buy a bunch of food and then, you know, don't replace your shoes and you have to throw out the food.
A friend of mine used the envelope system.
Sure.
And he'd put money away for food and this and that. And at day 21, he ran out of money for food. And he's a pretty big guy. He says, you know, fasting for 9 days is difficult. So he went to putting aside the money weekly.
Yeah.
And he said, if I run out of money on Friday and my internal payday is Monday, I can make it through the weekend with no food.
And this is going to be really unique for everybody based on your priorities. You and I like to read. Maybe we bought books, but then we didn't buy something else. So and that's the fun part. You get to make your own life there. But it's important to pay cash. Talk a little bit about like the upso. Maybe you've got a credit card because you're building your credit, and then you can't pay it off at the end of the month. And you say, cut it out, you're done. Tell me a little bit about avoiding debt.
Right, that's really, really important. And credit cards are great. They're great to accumulate travel points or cash points, all sorts of really helpful things can be done. But if the credit card is not paid off monthly, that's where we get into big trouble because they're super expensive. I can't even do the math. I've missed a payment or two, and then I get what the interest is.
Mm-hmm.
I can't figure it out yet exactly how they figure the interest, but it is severe. So you'd never want to miss paying it off at the end of the month. So using cash is the easiest way to make sure that you're not going into debt. Also, when you use cash, research shows you're going to spend, I think it's 18% less than you will when you use a credit card, because a credit card is painless, it's easy, but there's something about a connection between feeling the money and the brain. Research shows the brain lights up when we touch money. We're more judicious with it when we're actually handing over the cash.
A lot of young people aren't using cash at all, Rick. So would you recommend, you know, adding a step? So if you Venmo your friends because they paid for your drink at the bar with their credit card or their phone, their debit card, you're going to have to take another step to make that money be real to you. Maybe you're writing it down in a notebook. Maybe you're just spending time reflecting. You're going to have to do something to make it real. Because it's so easy to put your phone in front of something, click, spend, and then at the end of the week, not know where it all went.
Exactly. And that is a challenge. So tracking, some type of tracking is important. Mm-hmm. You'll figure out what works for you, because some folks won't have any problem at all. Those that are money vigilant, they're going to know where it's going. They're good at books. They're good at doing the accounting. But there's others, like money avoidant folks, that just does not register. Numbers just don't register.
Mm-hmm.
So probably the more money avoidant a person is, the more important it would be probably to use cash. But some type of a system is so important. I read an article just recently beseeching people to please use cash because of the dangers that will happen if cash completely disappears from our system. So it's a balance. You have to decide.
I have seen a lot of stores, small businesses, who are giving a discount for cash, who are encouraging, they're incentivizing spending cash.
Cash or checking account.
Yeah.
The other.
Yeah.
Where you actually transfer the money out of your checking account rather than on a credit card, because credit cards cost businesses 3-5%. So there's the incentive, is if you use cash, we don't have to pay that, and we'll give the savings to you, basically, is what they're saying. Now, that's a good deal. If you can save 3% on every purchase you make, that it sounds small and insignificant, but it's not worth putting it on a credit card if you have to pay 3% and you get the equivalent of 1% in spending on the card. Right. I figure, for example, I love to travel, and I try to get a cent and a quarter out of every point I get when it comes time to spend it. Well, it makes no sense to spend 3 cents when I have the option of paying in cash or by checking. I can spend a cent and a quarter of it.
You say when you get that first raise, don't go changing your lifestyle too quickly. Talk about as your income increases.
It's so normal that when we get a raise, it goes into the checking account and it's gone. And we expand our lifestyle. It's really important not to think about expanded lifestyle when the raise comes in. This can help reduce that 2-year period we talked about in building all of these funds up by saying, this is great. I can now put more into my building my emergency reserve. Mm-hmm. Or if you're not fully funding your retirement, for example, if you work for an employer with a 401k, I think it's $24,000 a year that you can put into that.
Okay.
Well, let's say you're putting in $15,000 a year. That's all you can work out with your paycheck. Well, put that raise into maximizing your retirement plan. So that if that's the first thought of, wow, how can I save this? How can I put it, help fund everything that comes off the list first, mm-hmm. of every dollar? How can I bolster that rather than how can I add it to my bottom line and spend it?
Invest in educating yourself and keeping abreast of changes in your career field. Talk about your career as a financial asset.
It's the biggest asset you've got. It's not going to be uncommon to earn over $1 million or much more during your work life.
Yeah.
You are your biggest income generator. So it's really important to invest in that business. We grow businesses by investing in them. Your small business person knows this, that whatever the profit is, that doesn't go into their pocket. There's a part of that that they have to reinvest in the business, in equipment, in keeping abreast of new technology and what's happening in their field. It's the same thing. Just think of yourself as You Inc. You've got to reinvest in yourself. It's really important. And as AI is changing jobs, I just read the other day that there's appraisers who are being basically put out of business by AI in certain instances. What's coming down for your career field? What are the changes that are going to happen? So this can be in continuing education. It can be in secondary education. But I'm thinking more of you've just gotten out of college. Yeah. You still can't stop investing in yourself.
If you have college debt, this is one of the things that you're going to have to be paying down unless you are part of the loan forgiveness program. But by and large, you're going to have to pay your student debt. Some people are looking back and getting some surprises after they graduated and maybe their deferment is up. Any advice to people who have credit card debt, who have a high house, you know, a higher than normal housing expense, just something that's getting in the way of what we would consider normal money management, but it's a temporary, but an acute sort of financial pressure. What's some of your advice to navigate that both emotionally and practically?
That is so common because we can often tend to accumulate this debt before we get the wake-up call that we're now adulting, that money just doesn't come out of the wall, which is as one kid described an ATM, and it's free. And all of a sudden we can find ourselves in debt. With credit card debt, the first thing that's important is to stop digging the hole. It will oftentimes call for some drastic lifestyle changes. Maybe it's downsizing in an apartment or house, downsizing in the car that a person drives, eating out less. There's a lot of things a person can do. They're not typically enjoyable and oftentimes difficult, and especially difficult emotionally.
Yeah.
That can stop us from stopping that spending locomotive that's gotten so much momentum, which is the debt. Got to stop the debt. And then with the debt, sometimes you can roll that debt over to a lower cost credit card. There's debt consolidation. You can reach out to the consumer credit counseling here in Rapid City of the Black Hills. I think about every city has an agency like this that can help with the consolidation of the debt. That can be important, but it's not the answer. The real answer is, why did this debt get there in the first place? Yeah. And what's happening within me if I can't stop? I mean, it's one thing to wake up and go, oh, money doesn't come out of the wall. Got it. I've got to cut my lifestyle. Got it. Done. But if a person can't have success doing that, they find themselves just continuing to spend, then consolidating the debt isn't going to do a thing. We've got to get to the underlying issue, the underlying pain in most every case, the underlying trauma or financial trauma that is coming out, so to speak, in the overspending.
As I look back at a lot of the things that we've said during this conversation, you know, the dollar signs kind of ring up of just how expensive it is to live. And thinking back to my 20s or thinking about some of the 20-year-olds I know, they're going to have to live really frugally. And they're going to look around and your friends might not be doing the same thing that you're doing. So you might be an outlier. If you practice sound money management, it's a little counterculture in American culture right now to be thrifty, to be frugal. We are a consumer society. We are having adventures. We have expensive phones. We have apartments that and first-time homes that are way nicer than what you and I would have picked up for our first-time home back in the days when the expectation was a little bit different. Leave us with something that sort of lets people know that if you're living in a way that other people your age aren't, that doesn't mean necessarily that they're successful and you're not.
Totally. Frugality is the common denominator of building wealth. It's so important. And to a lot of frugal people, it's a game. How can I get what I want for less? I actually had a client who had a super hard time not living frugally because it opened up their creativeness. They loved it when they lost their job. It was quite interesting to me. They loved it when things went bad because now they can be really creative. But they had a part of themselves that said, if things are going good, you can no longer be creative. You don't need that part of you. It was quite fascinating. So I'm not suggesting going to that extreme.
No self-sabotage is necessary.
So you can be creative and come alive. Yeah. You can have both. Mm. And so make it a game. There's all sorts of resources out there. I think my column appears in something called Dollar Stretcher, dollarstretcher.com maybe. Where there's sites, there's communities on how can you spend less. And there's just tons of ways that you can do that. And yes, that means insisting when you go out with a group that it's separate checks. That's a whole nother discussion. and not splitting the tab. It does set you apart a little bit. And it's helpful to focus on, well, what will my future self at 50, when I'm financially independent, how will I feel about that? And where will my friends be who just at 50 are discovering the fact that they're going to retire someday and they need to start saving?
Yeah, it's all worth it. The millionaire mindset is worth having and cultivating.
Yes. It's really important. And to your point, we are a consumer society. 50% of the country would have to borrow or sell something to come up with $400 or $1,000. We have an epidemic of overspending. We have an epidemic of undersaving. So you will be different. There's no question about it.
Rick Kaler is a wealth advisor and president of Kaler Financial in Rapid City. He is a vanguard in the field of financial therapy. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. In July, a new rule went into effect from the U.S. Department of Labor. The rule says salaried workers who earn less than $844 per week are now eligible for overtime pay. The threshold for overtime exemption increases again in January 2025. Next year, if you are a salaried employee making less than around $58,000 per year, you're about to be eligible for overtime pay. Department of Labor Wage and Hour Administrator Jessica Lumen explains how the rule affects South Dakota employees and employers.
The Fair Labor Standards Act is one of the foundational labor protection laws across our country. The laws that we enforce at the Wage and Hour Division protect about 165 million workers at 11 million workplaces. And one of the foundational pieces of labor protection law is that workers who work more than 40 hours in a work week get overtime. They get time and a half of their regular rate of pay. And so the Fair Labor Standards Act, or FLSA, as we like to call it, really provides for that protection. there are many exemptions from the protection of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And that means that those workers don't get minimum wage and overtime protections. And one of those exemptions is what we call the executive, administrative, or professional exemption, or EAP exemption, sometimes referred to as the white collar exemption. That exemption says that if you meet three criteria, you are not protected by the Fair Labor Standards Act minimum wage and overtime protections. Those three criteria are: one, that you are paid on a salary basis; two, that you meet the duties requirements of being an executive or an administrative professional or another kind of professional or outside sales or computer employees. There's a group of different types of work that's performed, and we have duties tests is what they're called. So you have to actually perform the duties of those types of workers. But the third part of the test is that you have to make at least a minimum salary in order to be exempt. So in order to not receive the protections. And starting on July 1st of this year, the salary went from about $684 per week to $844 a week. So that means that workers who make the equivalent of about $43,000 a year, those workers who make more than $43,000 a year may still be exempt if they meet those other two requirements. They meet the duties test and they meet the that they are paid on a salary level. But workers who make less than $43,000 a year, salaried workers who make less than $43,000 a year, starting on July 1 of this year, 2024, they now receive the protection of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which means that if you make less than $43,000 a year, you get overtime when you work more than 40 hours in a work week.
Would that have taken place automatically? Would an employee have to apply for it? Would a business owner have to make changes? How did it get rolled out in practicality?
The way that this went into effect is that the U.S. Department of Labor, we promulgated a new rule that went into effect on July 1 of 2024. And that means that when the new rule went into effect, that about 1 million workers across the country became protected by the minimum wage and overtime requirements of the Fair Labor Standards Act, because about 1 million people made less than $43,000 a year, but were being paid on a salary basis and were meeting the requirements of being under one of the exemptions, but they were not making that $43,000 a year. On July 1 of 2024, about 1 million workers automatically got the protection of minimum wage and overtime under the Fair Labor Standards Act because those workers made less than $43,000 a year, but more than the $36,000 a year threshold that was in effect before July 1. And then what's exciting is that then on January 1st of 2025, that number is going to change again. On January 1st of 2025, workers who make less than $58,000 a year will get minimum wage and overtime protections, which means that they will be paid time and a half when they work more than 40 hours in a work week.
How many people will that then impact in January of 2025?
Yeah, so we think that that'll impact about 3 million more workers across the country who will then become eligible for overtime protections when they work more than 40 hours in a work week because they make less than $58,000 annually.
In a situation where, like, this rule is to prevent what? Like, how bad could it be if an employer was trying to squeeze the most out of a lower salaried employee? What was potential, I don't want to call it a loophole, but what was potentially happening to people?
Well, I think that this is really, really important because, you know, when we were developing this rule, we talked to people all over the country. We talked to employers, we talked to workers all over the country. We had about 30 different listening sessions. We received 33,000 comments for this proposal and for this final rule. And those stories were incredibly compelling. Like you said, Lori, those stories were about workers who were making as little as $36,000 a year, but were being expected to work 40, 50, 60 hours in a work week without getting more compensation. These are workers who were performing both, yes, they were maybe a frontline supervisor, but they were also checking out customers or stocking shelves. You know, these are workers who really, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, should get the protection of minimum wage and overtime, but weren't getting the protections because their salary level had been so low. And really what we are trying to do with this rule and what we're committed to doing in the Biden-Harris administration, but you know, across the entire Department of Labor, is making sure that workers who should be getting the protections of the law actually get those protections.
You bring up an interesting point because some of the calls I've gotten have been people in the restaurant industry or in retail. And there are often people who are doing, you know, like you said, serving customers, stepping in and doing the work of a frontline worker, but then they're also managing. Are they exempt from the rules, from the FLSA?
It's a great question. So under the criteria for being exempt as an executive, administrative, or professional employee, you have to meet all three of the criteria. So you have to be paid a salary, and you have to be doing those kinds of supervisory or other types of executive, administrative, or professional work. But you also have to be paid this salary threshold. So workers who now make less than $43,000 a year, even if they are those frontline supervisors and they meet the duties test, they now are protected by overtime because they make less than $43,000 a year. And then as of January 1, they will now be protected and they will get overtime when they work more than 40 hours in a work week because they make less than $58,000 a year.
Okay.
So to your point, it's a really important point, which is that low wage salary workers will get overtime protection under this rule, already get it as of July 1, if they make less than $43,000 a year, but then we'll get it if they make less than $58,000 a year starting on January 1.
What is the impact as you did the listening sessions and the evaluations on small business owners throughout America?
We heard from a lot of small business owners, we heard from a lot of large business owners, and we heard from a lot of workers. And, you know, many of them are really focused on recruiting, retaining great workers, and they recognize that part of that commitment is that workers receive a fair wage, receive all of the protections that they should receive under the law. And so there were a lot of folks who were grateful to hear that we were making these incremental steps on July 1 and then January 1. And then there were some who were concerned that perhaps the salary threshold would have impacts in terms of their ability to either be able to pay overtime or to raise salaries in order to maintain the exemption. We've heard from a lot of those folks. And again, one of the things that we are here to do is we are here in the Wage and Hour Division to provide as much compliance assistance, help, resources, all of the things that employers might need in order to be in compliance with the law. We have a lot of resources on our website about this particular provision. We have FAQs, we have resources, and we also have offices all across the country. Our office that covers our friends in South Dakota is available to answer questions for any employers or workers who have any concerns about any wage and hour provisions, including this really important overtime rule.
More information on the rule can be found at dol.gov or call 866-4-US-WAGE. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.